In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We're pleased to bring you a special summer offer from our sister magazines. You can try 3 issues of BBC History Magazine or BBC History Revealed for just £5. That's a saving of up to 72% off the shop price. Plus, you'll receive free UK delivery on each issue. To find out more and take advantage of this offer, visit our official online store, buysubscriptions.com/podcast2021. If you're based in the US, you also won't miss out. You can try 3 issues for just $9.95, saving a huge 70%. For more details, visit buysubscriptions.com/podcast2021. Please be aware that both these offers end on the 31st of August 2021. And welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. In the 16th century, the city of Antwerp was a global centre of commerce, trade, knowledge and innovation, plus one of scandal, murder, secrets and intrigue. Michael Pye has written a new history of the city, Antwerp, the Glory Years, or if you're based in the US, it's published there under the title Europe's Babylon. Our content director, David Musgrove, called him to find out more.
Michael, so your book is called in the UK Antwerp, the Glory Years, and in the publisher's bump on the back of it, there's a little statement that says, before Amsterdam, another North Sea city was the hub of the known world, Antwerp. So that's a pretty big claim, and we're going to explore why Antwerp mattered in the 16th century. But first off, can you please just orientate us a bit. Where is Antwerp geographically today, and where did it sit in the political world in the 16th century?
Antwerp is in Belgium. Antwerp is a little way up a river, the River Scheldt, or just off the North Sea, as it were. So it's a port. It's always been an important port. It still is a hugely important port. And this is a town that was the target of German V2 rockets in World War II, was the first place where civilians were bombed in World War I. You go back, Antwerp has always had a strategic importance. It's an important port.
And in the 16th century, what was its position there? What was the state around it and what was its role?
though in the 16th century it was much more than just an important port. It really was the hub of the world that Western Europe knew. And I say that not just because I'm saying Antwerp matters, because I've written a book about it, but because that's what people at the time said. That's what diplomats said. That's what Venice, the great commercial power, said. Antwerp is the hub of the known world.
So Belgium wasn't a political entity in the 16th century. What was Antwerp? You know, what was its status? Where did it sit?
Well, Antwerp was supposed to be part of the Habsburg dominions. So it was ruled from Spain. It had a whole empire overlooking it. But it was a broke empire, didn't have any money. And the only place it could get money reasonably cheaply was Antwerp. So Antwerp was in a very odd position. It looks like an imperial possession, but in fact, it almost possessed the empire in some ways.
So who was in charge in the 16th century? Who ruled Antwerp?
Who ruled Antwerp? Ah, well, that is a really interesting question. Antwerp thought that Antwerp ruled Antwerp, which was very controversial. Theoretically, it was ruled by the Habsburgs from Madrid. So you have emperors who come to town to be welcomed as the rulers of the place. But Antwerp just got on with it. I mean, Antwerp and the emperors, it's a wonderful story. The emperor, Charles V, really disapproved of heresy. He wanted to destroy heretics as much as possible. And Antwerp was absolutely seething with heretics. It was full of people who were traders from all over the world. In fact, that's true, but certainly all over Europe. And many of them, for example, were Jews. Jews were particularly bad news to Charles V, who really disapproved of that kind of heresy. And he wanted to throw them out. But every time he tried, and he sent people from Brussels or Mechelen, the local headquarters of the empire, to get rid of them, there would be these little problems. So his ambassador would turn up in Antwerp and be told that, well, yes, the Margrave would really like to talk to him, but it was a little difficult because the Margrave was not very well. Perhaps he could wait till the next morning. And then when he suggested that the next morning at 6 o'clock would be a good idea, he was told, well, yes, but we don't really want to do it that early in the morning, do we? It'll just alarm people. And finally, he got to meet some of the people he wanted to meet. I mean, this, remember, is the emissary from the emperor. And unfortunately, it wasn't possible to do anything on account of everybody having escaped in the 12 or 15 hours that Antwerp had arranged for them. And this just went on and on. I mean, this is a city that wanted to be its own city, not like the other cities up and down the North Sea, which had a lord they really obeyed or had been built around a monastery or a bishop or that kind of authority figure. Antwerp was trying to work out how a city could be a city in its own right, how it could rule itself. It wasn't always terribly good at it, but it was a very, very interesting experiment.
So some of our listeners might be scratching their heads a bit and thinking, hang on, this place in Belgium is ruled from Spain. How did that happen? If people aren't aware of that story, are you able to sort of very quickly condense it for us? What were the origins of the city? How did it come to be ruled by the Habsburgs?
History of the Habsburg Empire. Yeah, right. The Habsburgs ruled because they conquered bit by bit the territory of what nowadays is Belgium and a bit of the Netherlands. They had, by inheritance, an interest in Burgundy, which was what the territory had been called before, and they extended it steadily. And that was how they had these enormous dynastic interests in the Spanish Netherlands.
And then beyond that, what were the countries around the Spanish Netherlands?
We've got France, which was always a problem. France was constantly invading and actually put Antwerp under siege at one point. You've got independent countries like Denmark and so on to the north. You've got bits and pieces of the Holy Roman Empire, which in theory was subject to the Habsburg Emperor at the time. So those are the things that are really around the Spanish Netherlands. But you see, for Antwerp, that wasn't really the point. The point of Antwerp was that you simply got on a ship at the docks and you went anywhere in the world that you wanted to. And remember, this is the time when the world is opening up. when suddenly there are the really good transoceanic routes that go to India, that go all the way down the coast of Africa, that go across to the Americas. And that's what Antwerp was connected to. So in a real sense, it was an international city, and not just hemmed in by enemies on the frontiers.
So, as you said, Antwerp becomes very important in the 16th century. Would I be right in saying that its rise mirrors the downfall, the decline of a nearby city of Bruges?
You would be absolutely right. I mean, without the complete fall of Bruges, Antwerp might not have made it. We have one other bit of geography we have to do. Flanders and Brabant, the two sort of territories side by side in the Spanish Netherlands. Flanders had been the one that actually got up the nose of the emperor in a really spectacular way. Brabant had been less so. Brabant had all sorts of deals, for example, with the English and their wool trade, which Flanders wouldn't do. So what you had in Antwerp, which was in Brabant, is a lot of friends that other territories didn't have, and that Bruges in particular didn't have. And when Bruges really irritated the emperor, I mean, it's always a bad idea to actually imprison a would-be emperor, even in a very nice house on a main square in Bruges. And also, if you do that, it's a very bad idea to have windows in the house that look out onto the place where you're actually executing some of his associates. It's not tactful at all. Anyway, Bruges was turned down and people moved out of Bruges. They had to. The other thing that happened actually is a much more basic rule of geography. The Scheldt has quite a current that goes up and down and really sweeps ships to the docks at Antwerp. Bruges, of course, never had a direct access like that. And its one little stream of water, as it were, which is what it became, was silting up steadily. So Bruges was always going to be isolated.
And I think, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but from reading your book, it looks as if Antwerp played quite a canny hand by its use of fares.
It was a brilliant idea. They had the advantage of being in Brabant, and their double advantage was that they could actually say, well, right, well, twice a year, we will have these enormous trade fairs, Antwerp and Bergen-op-Zoom, and they worked extraordinarily well. And all of a sudden, of course, if people wanted to do business at those fairs, they had to come from Bruges and do all their money business in Antwerp. And all of those things began to change the balance of power between the two places. Then when finally the Portuguese moved out, because they couldn't stand imperial hostility anymore in Bruges, they took the whole spice trade to Antwerp.
So, okay, so Antwerp quite rapidly becomes a centre of global commerce. What sort of activities are going on in Antwerp in the early 16th century?
Activity. Well, you've got all of the Portuguese trade, which is spice, which is diamonds, which is gold in Africa, and also, I have to say, the Portuguese were buying in Antwerp all the things that they needed in order to buy slaves in Africa. The merchants came from Italy. They came from most of the major Italian city-states. They came from Spain, obviously enough, in the Spanish Netherlands. But they came from England. The merchant adventurers had a centre in Antwerp. So the activity is buying and selling almost every imaginable thing. Because Antwerp was where you did the deals. It was where you did the exchanges. So the English would come in with large quantities of wool and woolen cloth, and they'd buy anything they could get. Antwerp was like their department store. They could buy wine, they could buy fish, they could buy anything, right up to the grander of metals and so on. So Antwerp is an emporium, as people kept saying, an emporium of the world. Think of it as a gigantic international version of Selfridges.
And did I read correctly in your book that it was something like 9/10 of the English woolen produce was going through Antwerp?
It was all landed in Antwerp, yes. But the other beauty of Antwerp, it had a very sensible rule, which was that you didn't actually have to unpack anything if you landed it in Antwerp, or indeed pay any taxes on it, or indeed do anything dull like putting it through customs. So if you landed in Antwerp, you simply put it on a cart or a boat or a barge and took it on to wherever it was going to. And that was a huge advantage. All of a sudden, there was no problem with shipping on, Antwerp could be the place in the middle for everybody.
So at what point does Antwerp become like the global centre then? Is there like a particular year or decade when it really comes to prominence in your view?
You could say it was 1502 when the first Portuguese spice ships arrived, because that threw the whole really important spice trade to Antwerp. Or you could argue it was later, because what was happening year by year, decade by decade, was that people found Antwerp just really convenient. The South German miners who wanted to bring their minerals to sell could do the deals in Antwerp and pick up with the letters of credit all the goods that they needed from around the world, the stuff that was coming in from the Americas by way of Seville, from Africa by way of Lisbon, from India by way of Lisbon. So again, it was the centre of things. It was the hub.
So it's connecting all these different areas. It's connecting America, Asia, Europe, Africa. The whole, basically, the whole as the globe becomes more connected in the as 16th century goes on, Antwerp is a pivotal place.
Absolutely, the pivotal place. And it's a very strange business, because it's this history of that city, because it's an astonishing city in that period, somehow got lost along the way. And there's a good reason, which is that at the end of the century, at the end of the 16th century, the Habsburgs were firmly back in control, and they sat on the city, and they imposed their own bureaucracy. They made the city only Catholic. The heretics were thrown out. And so we think of Antwerp as the city of Rubens and of that kind of art, that kind of diplomacy, that kind of imperial ambition. No, but it wasn't before that. In its glory days, it was the exact opposite. And unfortunately, in the meantime, a large number of mutinous troops in 1576 had managed to burn the upper stories of the town hall and burn its records. So you have a situation where reconstructing this wonderful history that everybody at the time was talking and writing about involves going for every kind of source you can find, every novel that was being written. Yes, there were novels being written. The pictures, the documents that you can find in archives from Zurich to Venice to Lisbon. It's a matter of reconstructing a story that wasn't deliberately put away, but nevertheless was put away with enormous efficiency.
We'll come back to the end of the city's glory years in a bit, and you've done some really interesting investigative work, as you said, to try and find out what's going on. But I just want to drill into those glory years. So you've described how it's an emporium for goods coming from all around the world and being centered into Antwerp. But was it a place of innovation as well? I'm thinking financial innovation. Were there financial products being developed as alongside the commercial activities?
Huge, because the real surprise is that it was a hub of information as well. Every kind of information, medical information, information about trade in different places, obviously. All of these things were happening. So it was a city of spies, because people wanted to find out what was happening. It was a city of doctors who wanted to find out the newest cures, but also how to use them. Because there's not much point in having an interesting dried root sitting in front of you if you don't actually know whether you're supposed to grind it or put it in water for 36 hours or whatever. You have to have the information. You have to have the theory, if you like. And the result is a place where everything is up for grabs. The merchants themselves are the scholars very often. They don't see a distinction between the two things, although they sometimes get quite cross that business gets in the way of doing anything else. So unsurprisingly, it's a place where people innovate. And not surprisingly, when you've got a place which is so much the centre of information coming from everywhere, where nothing is to be taken for granted anymore, where the streets are full of spies, you've got a place where things start again. And if you've got a place where people don't have a literal market, I mean, you don't take in a cabbage and get money for it. If you've got a place where everything is theory in a way, because you've got people doing deals where the goods just aren't there, or they're not going to come for a long time. It's a futures market, if you like. Of course, you get innovation. And more you get a class of people who have come from somewhere else, operating in Antwerp, and everything to them is remote from the goods and the physical things and the physical trade. So all of a sudden you've got a theoretical trade. You've got finance instead of markets.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Nobody saw the need to actually beat up people for having the wrong ideas in theology. And people were discreet enough, as they had to be, to go on with trade, because that was what mattered.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So we're getting to a point where you, knowledge really is power in this situation then. Tell me about Antwerp's role in the printing industry, because it takes quite a prominent role there, doesn't it?
Antwerp's in the printing industry is absolutely central. For a start, if anybody wanted to learn another language, something like 7/8 of all the language books published in Europe were published in Antwerp during the 16th century. But it was also a place where information came in fairly easily, because Antwerp would never actually get round to prosecuting publishers for what they were doing, or if they did so, they didn't use major penalties. Antwerp never imposed the death penalty, for example, for publishing a heretical book. They banished people, which meant they sort of had to live a little bit outside the city for a bit if they didn't mind, and that was about it. So with that kind of freedom, with the trading which allowed new material to come in, and paper, most important, because paper was quite difficult at that point, and getting paper in from France needed the Antwerp docks. All of that meant that Antwerp became not just a printing and publishing centre, but a centre, a real city of information. If you wanted a sort of early equivalent of how the internet works now, with people being able to access the most surprising things, then it would be Antwerp.
And I think in your book, you also describe it as a city of teachers.
Oh, it was. An incredible number of people actually worked as teachers. People went to Antwerp to learn languages because Antwerp was famous for speaking so many. It had to be, of course. I mean, a big trading city with people from all over. You have to learn other languages. And teaching was the industry. And teaching is fascinating because it teaches us in its own right so much about what the society was really like. I mean, what did people think about the women of Antwerp, who were famous? I mean, they were scandalous. People talked about the fact that you could tell dirty jokes in front of a woman. You could actually talk to a woman when her husband wasn't there, which really shocked the Italians, who were used to keeping their daughters really safely and locked up at home. And through the language books, we get a sense of this great desire to be sort of respectable, but not to go too far with it. And it goes back to the old statement about Antwerp, which was various people, including the Venetian ambassadors, said, well, yeah, of course, they are drunk all the time, which is rather a problem. But on the other hand, they've got a solution, which is that the men drink a great deal, which means the women do the business. He then pointed out the women drank just as much. But there we are. They obviously had better heads.
You've mentioned languages a couple of times. Was there a lingua franca that you needed to speak in Antwerp to be understood? And how many languages do you suppose were being touted on the streets?
At least five or six, because you've got Netherlandish, as it would be called at the time, rather than Dutch. You've got French, of course, you've got Italian, you've got Spanish, you've got Portuguese, and you've got various forms of German, Plattdeutsch and all the rest of it. So at least six. Lingua franca, that's one possible push for why all of a sudden finance becomes so abstract. That's what you're dealing with. You're dealing with the equivalent of a spreadsheet, not a spreadsheet at the time, but the equivalent. And you're dealing with trade in that kind of intellectual level, if you like. And you do numbers, not the languages.
So you've described here quite clearly a vibrant city, a city where a lot's going on, a city where information as well as goods are flowing in and out. I wonder whether you're able to identify any of the sort of modern concerns that come with cities through your research. So when we talk about a city today, people talk about transport, they talk about house prices, they talk about planning, they talk about street safety. Have you been able to see any of those sorts of things coming through on top of the general global importance of the place?
Well, I don't want to sound like a Daily Mail editorial, but house prices going up was an absolutely vital part of the Antwerp economy. I mean, lots of people went into business because they could do it after selling a couple of properties that had been in the family for some time. Street safety was always a problem. The cobblestones never got replaced in time. There was too much dust around or too much mud. It was always problematic. But the planning of the city was also an issue, a really live issue, towards the end of the century. At first, there was just one extraordinary man called Gilbert von Schönbecker, who was a sort of developer, a hyper-developer, a sort of monster developer, the Godzilla of developers, who did deals all over the city, got out of them as quickly as possible, and left behind whole new districts of the city. Quite extraordinary that one man could do that. And the city didn't have the politics to control him. So he got on with remaking the shape of Antwerp. And as time went on, people began to think, well, wait a minute, I mean, he's reshaping our city. We really want our city to be something different. And when in the 1570s and 80s, there was a Calvinist Republic of Antwerp, and not coincidentally, they were beginning to smash down a few convents and church institutions and had the space, they start talking about town planning in surprisingly modern terms. They want beauty. They want elegance. They want openness. And they start thinking about some of the things that Antwerp really hadn't thought enough about, like how you were going to drain everything and how you were going to get rid of things that you wanted to get rid of. No sewers that were working.
You just mentioned there Calvinism. You've talked about heresy a bit as well in this conversation. The 16th century, of course, is the period when we start to see the big clash between Catholicism and Protestantism and how that, you know, racked Europe. What was Antwerp's place in that religious story?
As far out of it as they could stay, until there was a catastrophe and they couldn't stay out any longer. It's extraordinary. I mean, what she had was a situation where they were Calvinists, but they were so amazingly discreet that nobody was really aware of their existence until all of a sudden they started preaching in the hedges outside Antwerp. And there was an iconoclasm, a moment when the churches were attacked in 1556. The point is that people didn't actually fight about religion until quite late in Antwerp, which is an important part of its success. It's not that they thought that there was an alternative to Catholicism. They had processions in the streets for the sacraments. They honoured on the Lieve Frau, Our Lady, the Virgin Mary. All of that was absolutely solid Catholic. But at the same time, nobody saw the need to actually beat up people for having the wrong ideas in theology. And people were discreet enough, as they had to be, to go on with trade, because that was what mattered. Just think of who the traders were. They were Calvinists, they were Lutherans, they were Jews, They were all of the people that were officially disapproved of as heretics, but the heretics were the engine of the city. And that kept Antwerp to some extent out of the worst conflicts of the Reformation until the point where the empire insists that actually being a heretic is worse than being a heretic. It's actually lèse majesté. It's an offence against the crown.
So to stay out of these debates, was Antwerp a well-defended place? Was it a military power in any way?
Oh, no, the walls were constantly falling down and it never had a navy. It always had to hire ships from the north. One of the ways Amsterdam made money out of Antwerp in the early days. And nothing like that. Antwerp with an army? I mean, it had night watches and it had militias, which were as efficient as militias ever were. But that wasn't the point at all. That wasn't its power. Its power was very modern. It was information.
Now, before we get on to the final decline, I wonder if I'd been able to wander the streets of Antwerp in the 16th century, would I have seen famous people with famous names there?
Well, you might not have done, depends on which you were wandering through. You'd have seen the Bruegels, of course. You would have seen Erasmus from time to time. You would have seen... I mean, actually, if you want any of the major 16th century figures who sort of have some connection with the Netherlands, then you would have found them somewhere. You'd find Albrecht Dürer, for example, who spent a lot of time in Antwerp, actually. Stole quite a lot of information about defensive architecture from our Antwerp and didn't acknowledge it when he wrote a book. But yes, you would have seen lots of people. But they would have been a real mix.
And so how diverse was the city? Was it a genuine melting pot of people from all over the world?
Yes, it was a real melting pot. It had more Africans lived in Antwerp, as far as we know, than in any other European city except Lisbon. And when you remember that Lisbon, the African population was extremely visible because for some reason the ferrymen were almost all African. For the Africans in Antwerp to be as visible is quite extraordinary. There must have been an awful lot of black people there. You have merchants who send people to look after their business in Antwerp. So you have the Genoese worrying about the pictures they'll buy, and you have the Medici's men worrying about the horses they'll buy, and you have the people from Spain and from Portugal also worrying about what they'll buy. Extraordinary mixture, absolutely extraordinary. A lot of people at the time talked about the number of languages you heard on the streets in Antwerp.
Okay, so a global city with a global population and talked about globally by the sound of what you describe in your book, somewhere that was famous around the world.
Oh, it was scandalous around the world. It was completely scandalous. I mean, you have to think of Antwerp in the early 16th century like, oh, I don't know, Paris in the 19th century or New York in the 20th century. No story coming from there was completely incredible. You really believed it first and worried about the details later. It's a story of killer bankers. I mean, one of my problems in the book actually was cutting out the killer bankers, far too many of them, and really one or two is really quite enough for that species. You have stories of sexual scandal because everybody had this sense that somehow Antwerp wasn't following the rules properly, and that women were beginning to reinvent who they could be and what they could do. All of these things were happening, and they added, and the reputation was extraordinary. And the best thing you could do if you were a merchant travelling in Europe was to go to dinner parties with two really good Antwerp stories. They would get you the attention of everybody at the table. You just had to tell them you were in.
Okay, so finally to wrap up, how do Antwerp's glory years end? You've sort of already mentioned a little bit about it, but just take us to the close of the story and what happens to the city.
It's a very sad story. You've got a city which had managed to work out a way of living with the facts of the Reformation, which is quite astonishing. Yes, it was Catholic on the surface, a lot of Catholic observance, but people could think and do what they wanted to do. All of that breaks down. It breaks down, first of all, with iconoclasm, with a handful of people running through the streets of Antwerp, smashing up churches and images and statues. When that has happened, The Spanish in Madrid obviously think, right, this can't happen. We can't have this kind of disorder. Right, we are going to send in the troops. They do. There are strong laws against heresy. When the troops mutiny because they haven't been paid, Antwerp all of a sudden can choose again. But now Antwerp has to make a choice, Catholic or Calvinist, and chooses to be Calvinist. And the Calvinist Republic is set up. And that, of course, the Spanish have to fight tooth and nail, which they do. So you end up with a city which had managed somehow to opt out of the worst of war and the worst of conflict, suddenly being thrust right back into the middle of it. And it's burnt, and it's ruined, and it's miserable. And it's a terrible end to what has been an absolutely glorious story.
And the final point is, as you make in your book, is that ending, that burning, has perhaps sort of tarnished our knowledge of it because the records were burnt and people haven't been able to study it as much as they might do. So perhaps Antwerp today isn't as famous as it might be for the role that you see it had in the 16th century.
Well, I mean, obviously, I think that Antwerp should be very, very, very famous indeed. It's not just the destruction of the records. It's the fact that when you go to Antwerp now, you see it as Rubens' city, which is the 17th century, not a 16th century city. You see it as a place of sort of the remains of a kind of imperial glory, which is really not what it was in its true glory years.
That was Michael Pye. His book, Antwerp, the Glory Years, is published in the UK on the 5th of August and in the US with the title Europe's Babylon on the 7th of September. Thanks to Esme McNamara for additional interview research for this episode. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. On Friday, I'll be speaking to Nick Hayes about the history of trespass.